Whenever Johnny told me the passage that he had allocated to me today, I was really quite excited because over the years I have been very fortunate indeed to have visited the remains of Corinth on several occasions. So what I'd like to do really at the beginning is to try and paint a picture for you and invite you to enter into Paul's feelings and mindset as he approached Corinth. Corinth was one of the megacities of its day. At its peak, it had a population of something like 700,000. Now, to put that in context, Belfast has a population of just under 300,000, and the metropolitan area of Belfast has a population of just under 600,000. So this was a big, big city. To this day, the excavations only cover about 5% of it. It had been levelled by the Romans in 146 BC in the course of the Roman Wars. The city had been absolutely wiped out, literally levelled. And then about 100 years later, Julius Caesar decided that he would rebuild it. And he did rebuild it, and he gave it the status of a Roman colony. And because of its position, you can see from the map there that Corinth lies in a very strategic position. It grew quickly. And by the time we get to the events of the chapter that you've heard read, which is about 51-52 AD, Corinth was the commercial capital of Greece. The map's not altogether clear, but you can probably see that Corinth sits at the end of a little land bridge that joins it with the northern part of Greece, the Greece part of Greece where Athens is. Now, a land bridge is good unless you happen to be a ship owner. And as you can see, that little land bridge cut off the northern part of the Gulf of Corinth from the Saronic Gulf on the south, or maybe that's the other way around, I'm not too sure. But one way or another, if you're a ship owner, that added something like 200 miles to your journey if you were trying to get to Athens. And so they decided that one way to get around that was to actually take the ships out of the water and drag them the 4 miles across the land bridge and plop them down in the water on the other side. Since 602 BC, it's a long, long time ago, people had been trying to build a canal across there. Three different Roman emperors had a go at it: Caesar, Nero, and Caligula. They all failed. And so did others, until we get to 1893 and a canal was built. It still operates today, although it's mainly for tourists now. And Corinth had two ports, one on either side of the land bridge. So all trade, north-south or east-west, in that part of the world went through Corinth. And so it became a very prosperous city. This is probably the street that Paul lived on. And as you can see on that street, towering over it, there is a hill, which was and still is the Acropolis of Corinth. And on the top of that hill, there was a temple to Aphrodite, the goddess of love. a temple with 1,000 female prostitute slaves who served there during the day and nightly offered their sexual favors throughout the city. So infamous was Corinth that the Greek word to act like a Corinthian meant to practice fornication. And the description Corinthian girl was an allegation of prostitution. Corinth was very proud of the fact that it was a Roman city. It had numerous temples throughout the city, but the temples to Roman gods and goddesses, and particularly to the Roman Empire, were set up on higher ground than the other temples, just to make the point that we're top dog here. And that is a part of the Roman temple that is still there to this day. I think those pillars have probably been re-erected, but that's what you see if you go to the city today. Now, as we come to our passage, and with that picture in your mind, I want to look at three things. I want to see how Paul arrived at the city. Then I want us to think about what Paul preached in the city. And then I want us to look at how God worked in the city. And we actually can do that very easily because the data that we need, if you want to put it that way, are set out by Paul himself in a subsequent letter, or else they're recorded here by Luke in the Acts of the Apostle. Now, if you're one of those people who absolutely demands that you have 3 points all beginning with the same letter, then the points are Paul, preaching, and providence. But I'm just going to use these three, so hopefully honor is satisfied. So first of all, let's have a look at how Paul arrived. Well, he arrived probably rather wearily. He would have walked the 50 miles from Athens. You know, 50 miles is not a short journey, even on a bicycle. But if you're walking over unmetalled roads, over hills and lanes, it is an exhausting experience. And his experiences of the previous few months were weighing heavily on him. He had been badly beaten in Philippi. The severity of the beating was such that almost certainly he was still suffering from the pain and injuries of it. He had been run out of Thessalonica after 3 weeks, and at this stage in the story, didn't know if anything very much was happening there. He had started well in Berea, but again, very quickly, had to leave. He had got to Athens. He had debated with the philosopher, and then he had been in front of the Areopagus. Now, the Areopagus was not the debating society bit of Athens. Areopagus was the court side of Athens. This was the highest court in the city. And he effectively was being tried. And the important thing there was that he, as the Bible said, left their presence, which meant that he hadn't been convicted. Or in a sense, he had got off with what he was talking about. But there was an implied warning there when some said, "We want to hear you again." And he seems to have left Athens pretty quickly after that. And now here he is, trudging through the port and the suburbs of the most immoral, most Roman, most materialistic, most socially conscious city in that part of the world. He himself, physically battered, tired, emotionally distressed, deeply apprehensive. And we know that because he told us. I came to you in weakness and fear and with much trembling. Paul was a remarkable man, a remarkable servant of God, one of the greatest. Paul and I wouldn't really be in the same book, never mind the same spectrum. But those words are one which I, who am none of those things that Paul was, can identify with, and for much less reason. And I was wondering if that might be how you, some of you, come to church this morning, in physical or emotional pain, tired and done in, wishing you lived in a different world at the moment, not the messed up, morally challenging, financially stressful, relationally broken mess that's all around us. It could just be that that's the way you might be feeling this morning, just like Paul. And as he walked through Corinth, I wonder, did he see much that encouraged him? Through the port, with all the things that are associated with a port city. As he made his way towards the center of the city, pagan temples all around him. The girls from Aphrodite's temple with their shaven heads round the city at every corner. What was there going to be? What was there going to be to encourage this man? Well, nothing very obvious. Except, as it turned out, God. God had made preparations for Paul. And he made preparations for Paul in the form of Aquila and Priscilla, who were presumably believers before they arrived in Corinth. Aquila was from Pontus, on the southern shore of the Black Sea, and he had, for some reason or another, made his way to Rome. We don't know whether he was married at this point or whether he met Priscilla in Italy. But eventually Claudius, the Roman emperor, in retaliation for disturbances among the Jews, told them all to get out. Now, it may actually have been that those disturbances had to do with the disruption caused by the gospel, because the historians refer to somebody as Crestus, which the theologians feel may well have been a reference to Jesus. However, off they went, and where did they end up? Unlikely believers in Corinth. Even better than that, for Paul, they turned out to be tent makers, leather workers, and they had enough space for him to live with them and to work with them. And that was the way Jewish rabbis operated. They didn't get paid for their teaching. They were meant to have a job that kept them alive, kept them in business, while they gave their teaching and their discussions for free. Now, I don't think it would be stretching the text too far to observe that often when we are at our lowest, but are intentional in our desire to be servants of the gospel, we find that God has already made preparations. Priscilla and Aquila would turn out to be long-term friends and a fundamental part of Paul's ministry in the years to come. We learn from the concluding chapter in Romans that they had risked their lives for Paul. And by then they were back in Rome where the church met in their house. And incidentally, something I hadn't noticed before, in that same passage he mentions Phoebe, a servant of the church where? In Cenchrea, which was one of the ports of Corinth. How Paul arrived. Paul, as usual, when he arrived, went to the synagogue. There was definitely a synagogue in Corinth because in the excavations they have found the lintel of it, which says Synagogue of the Hebrews. And we assume that he took his normal approach, that he started with Abraham, he talked through the Exodus, talked about David, he talked about exile, he talked about hope, and he talked about the Messiah and how the Messiah had actually come as promised and was Jesus. But by his own account, while I'm sure that was in his preaching, but by his own account, when he came to Corinth, he was more focused. This is what he said. I resolved to know nothing while I was with you, but Jesus Christ and him crucified. So every Sabbath, there he was in the synagogue, reasoning, debating, demonstrating, and an important word, persuading. Persuading people that Jesus was the Messiah. Now, we don't know what Paul's own evaluation of his work in Europe up to that point was, whether he saw it as one of success or did he have a sense of disappointment that contributed to his mood. Work in the synagogue seems to have been on a fairly minor scale, Sabbath by Sabbath. But God intervenes again. And suddenly into Corinth come Silas and Timothy. They bring news, really good news, that despite the brevity of his visits and his hurried departure, the church in Thessalonica has taken root and the testimony of the believers is strong. So much so that it was here in Corinth that Paul wrote his letters to the Thessalonians. And I'm not going to do it, but if you really want to get an idea of what Paul was probably thinking about in Corinth, what his key concerns were in Corinth, they are probably reflected in what he wrote to the Thessalonians. But that's for a theologian to sort out. Now, meanwhile, as this was happening, interest in the synagogue seemed to have turned to opposition and abuse. So he left, and he left quite dramatically. He didn't just slide out and say, I'm off, guys. He took his clothes and very ceremonially shook every piece of dust out of them. And then he said, and this is also important, you are now accountable yourself for how you evaluate Jesus. And that's a reminder to this day, a reminder that has gone down through the years of history since then, and perhaps a reminder to someone in the church this morning that when you are faced with the news of Jesus, that when you are made aware of the claims of Jesus, that when in your heart of hearts you know you ought to do something about Jesus and you turn away, that accountability is all yours. So it was a solemn moment. He then moved his meetings next door. He wasn't sort of, in a sense, getting out of their face here. He moved next door to the house of another believer, Titius Justus. And who should join them but Crispus and his whole family? And that was important because Christus has been the head of the synagogue, the chief person in the synagogue. So encouragements were beginning to mount up for this down-at-heart disciple. Now, I hear myself and others around me say, or at least think, something like this. We Christians are so out of touch with the world that no one will listen to us. Our views on identity, sexual morality, same-sex relations, abortion, honesty, faithfulness, and a whole raft of other things mean that our message is doomed before we start. And so we conclude in practice, if not in thought, that we won't even start. Think of Paul in Corinth. To the Jews, a crucified Messiah was a contradiction in terms. It just, you know, didn't make sense. Imagine the Roman reaction to the idea that their Lord should be a Jew and not a Roman emperor. Of all the subjugated people that they might have chosen, a Jew, really? And not just a Jew, but a crucified Jew. And to the Roman, the Greek, and the Jew, a Messiah that rose from the dead was just ridiculous. And into that world comes Paul with his message of the crucified Jesus. As John Stott remarks, it was surely the pride and immorality of the Corinthians which intimidated Paul, since the cross comes into direct collision with both. And if our gospel does not have moral implications, then it is not the gospel. And if it does have moral implications, among many, it will not be welcome. And indeed, it may be that there are people in the church this morning that find that particularly challenging. Because you know that were you to come to Jesus today, or maybe a Christian where if you were to full-heartedly follow Jesus today, that would have a real implication on how you lead your life. But that's what the gospel does. This was the city that Paul was in. And none of that took him by surprise, because this is what he says. The Jews demand miraculous signs, the Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. Paul knew exactly where he was and exactly what he was doing. What did God do? Well, God, having already introduced Priscilla and Aquila to Paul and brought Silas and Timothy with good news from Thessalonica, plus a gift, we think, that allowed him to work full time now in his mission. He had been able to set the tent making to one side and operate from Justice's Hall more or less full time. God now gives him a vision. Luke records lots of visions. Chapter 9, Ananias. In chapter 10, Peter and Cornelius. In chapter 16, 17, 22, 23, and 27, Paul. It seems that in the unique circumstances of the early church, it was something God used regularly. And Paul speaks of them again in 2 Corinthians 12. Now, we know that God still uses visions, but not often in our proud, cynical Western world. Although I must tell you that at least once in my life, someone had a vision about Jean and I. And it was a vision that spoke into our lives at a particular point with a particular decision that this person could have known nothing about. So God still does operate in miraculous ways. On this occasion, Paul is assured that the attacks and abuse which marked his previous European experiences will not recur, and he need not fear and should keep on speaking. God also reveals to him his divine purpose, but I want to come back to that in a moment. Enough to say that this vision opened up the possibility that Paul would be able to stay for a long time in this city. And indeed he did, for something like 18 months. But it was tested at some point in that 18 months because the Jews went to Gallio, the proconsul, with a complaint. Now, when Paul was in Philippi, he had been accused of teaching Jewish customs that would have been illegal for the Romans. In Thessalonica, he was accused by the Jewish community of teaching contrary to Caesar's decrees. Here in Corinth, he was accused of persuading people to worship God in ways that were contrary to the Jewish law. Now, it may have been that Paul, in reciting the Shema, the Jewish declaration, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is one," had added, as he did in 1 Corinthians 8:6, "and there is but one Lord, Jesus Christ." That's speculation. But you could see how that might have been the case. Now, there's real danger here, because if the Romans felt he was promoting a Lord other than Caesar, the punishment would be severe. I want you to look at this little bit of marble column in front of you. That is actually where Paul stood on that day, beside that particular piece of marble in Corinth. At least so the archaeologists assure us. And that is where Paul would have been beaten had Gallio not found in his favor. And when we put that in the slightly bigger context, you can see the piece of marble over to the right of the picture there. But in front of it is the bema, the judgment seat, from which Gallio would have heard his case. Now, you notice that the power picture here is very clear. Gallio up on a raised platform. In practice, I guess that's probably more than 6 feet. I can remember I couldn't quite see over it. And Paul down below. Now, Gallio was an interesting and influential man in Roman affairs. He was son of Seneca the senior and brother of Seneca the philosopher. But he very quickly decided that this was an internal Jewish matter, and he refused to hear the case. It has been suggested that he had heard of Paul's reputation for very lengthy addresses, and he didn't want to sit through a long exposition of Jewish quarrels. That is purely speculation, and I wouldn't comment on it. But anyway, he dismissed it. And the good news for Paul was that he had effectively ruled that being a Jesus follower was to be seen in Roman law as a variation within Jewish life. Now, that may seem a little abstruse, but let me follow that up. That was really important because Jewishness, the Jewish religion, was an authorized religion in that part of the world. The Romans had accepted it as something that the Jews could do. And now by Gallio making this ruling, he had in fact passed a favorable verdict on the Christian faith and thus established a very significant precedent. As John Stott puts it, the gospel could not now be charged with illegality. That was an amazing thing to happen at this stage in the church's history. And it happened in Corinth, right there. But there was one other critical thing that God revealed to Paul. He said to him, I have many people in this city. People who have not yet believed, but would do so as Paul proclaimed the gospel of Jesus. Unlike elsewhere, as I say, Paul stayed for 18 months and a significant church was established. It had all sorts of issues as they moved from Corinthian culture to kingdom culture, and it wasn't easy, but God's word prevailed. As John Stott says, the word of God is the divinely appointed means by which people come to put their trust in God and thus identify themselves as his. So you see how all this works in some mysterious way. God says to Paul, I have lots of people in this city. Paul, you go and tell them about Jesus. Paul, as they accept Jesus, they reveal what I have known all along. That's God's anointed, divine way. Which raises the interesting challenge. God also has people in Bangor. And we are given the responsibility of spreading that divine word. Not primarily in this building, because most people will not be here. But in our day-to-day living, wherever that may be. That's God's appointed divine way. And the invite, indeed, he commands us to be involved. We leave Paul as he sets off to Ephesus with Priscilla and Aquila. Notice that by now the names have been reversed, but that's for another day. The wife's name comes first now rather than the man's. That's for another day and somebody else. Paul has come from the intellectual capital, Athens, to Corinth, the commercial capital, and now he's off to Ephesus, another enormous and commercially successful city, but one which is typified as a religious capital. It was a city just absolutely coming down with every religion the ancient world knew. But as he leaves Corinth, what have we learned for our small city with a long Christian heritage? Well, I'd like to make three suggestions. that you may wish to take with you as you leave. Even when we are at our lowest, if we are willing, God will encourage, equip, and even use us. And that, I suspect, has been the experience of many people in the church. You really don't need me to tell you that. But maybe you need me to remind you of it. Because when that crushing sense of failure comes upon us, comes upon me, I do need to be reminded of that. The second thing is this. However countercultural and unacceptable the message of the cross seems to be, to us it is the powerful word through which God works. Yes, we have to give a reason for the hope that's within us. Very, very few people in my experience are argued into the kingdom. They are brought into the kingdom as the Holy Spirit places on hearts and lives and minds the implications of the cross. And finally, God has his people, yet unsaved in Bangor, who await our testimony, your testimony perhaps, however feeble you might feel it will be. Even when we're at our lowest, if we're willing, God will encourage, equip, and use us. However countercultural and unacceptable the message of the cross seems to be, it is the powerful word through which God works. God has his people as yet unsaved who await our testimony, however feeble we may feel it to be. Let us leave here this morning encouraged.